She does not give to her home the radiance of her strength, her peace or her inspiration. She does not give that spiritual fecundity of a wife-mother that is so essential. She does not contribute to the world those values of goodness, piety and warmness of heart without which there can be no real human relations. Above all, she does not express the revelation and the rich symbolism of a humanity that is open and receptive to the gift of God. That is why, by the same refusal, she no longer gives to God what he expects of her. If woman symbolizes, as Gertrude von Lefort has said, all the power of offering in the universe, then God can only find in a woman closed in upon herself a world closed to his love. The litany calls Mary the gate of heaven. The symbolism of the door is expressive, for woman is the door of heaven. If she is closed, there is no longer a door between the world and God, nor between God and the world. Thus a world without woman is not a human world. We can judge civilizations on their attitude towards woman. If she is not present, we may be sure that cynicism, bad faith, pride and cruelty prevail in society. A premium is set on politics, technology and economics. It is, of course, quite probable that woman will be displayed on the screen and in popular magazines. But what kind of woman? The star, the pin-up and a whole parade of women who no longer give anything but their empty bodies, their impersonal sex. This is the selfish woman, the woman who adores herself and seeks to be adored. But this adoration is a cult of mockery of which, in the end, she herself is the victim. All trace of the woman who bears the signs of grace and love is banished. The sin of woman has any number of ramifications. Refusing her beautiful gift of dedication, hardening in the cult of herself, she lets the world slowly desiccate in pride and ultimately in despair. And what is so terrible in all of this is that she still retains her power of fascination that excites men and secretly seduces them. This is a road that leads nowhere, for the door that should open upon God is closed. I wonder whether women who are most convinced of their powers and most intoxicated with their beauty, reflect upon the immense hope they raise in the heart of a man and the immense despair into which they can plunge him? Here again I quote Gertrude von Lefort, Eve is never the power of evil in itself. The fallen angel exceeds her in revolt, and the devil is masculine, but she shares his power of seduction. Seduction is self-will, the opposite to surrender. That is the real sin of woman. Nevertheless, in this matter of sin, woman is not alone to blame. Man is also responsible. The image he has made of woman is an idol of sin. And women, who often see themselves through the eyes of men, strive to resemble that image. Let us not be too quick to cast stones at her. If woman must refashion a true concept of her personality and of her mission, this conversion does not depend less on man. He must cease imprisoning her in an inferior world of domestic duties. He must see something more in her than her makeup and figure and begin to believe in her personality. He must have confidence in her dignity and solicit her inspiration, make her his companion and his equal in society. Then we would quickly change the course of our civilization from perdition to redemption. The mystery of woman illumines history, and particularly the religious history of mankind. The Bible indicates this when it recounts the roles of Eve and Mary. Woman is not called upon to act, to be seen or to give orders. It suffices that, in the penumbra, she attracts and inspires. She is given to man as the earth that nourishes him, as the air he breathes, as the distant light that is perhaps a dawn. All of history, in which the spiritual destiny of man is worked out, is made of this antagonism or of this alliance between feminine and masculine values. If they are in conflict, if one wishes to conquer and stifle the other, human progress falters over the brink of disaster. If they are joined in harmony, there is a chance for grace to triumph. Thus woman stands both in and above history as the great sign of perdition or redemption. In the manner that she sees herself, and that man sees her, we can judge whether God is present or absent from the world. Such is her mystery, and it is essentially a religious mystery even when we are not aware of it. When we examine her personality, her mission and her symbolism, we come closer to God and His love. Henceforward we hold one of the keys to the human condition. With woman, the world is a country of deep springs teeming with life. Without her, it is only a desert of sand. Chapter V. The Man's Father. In silent moments of reflection, man may catch a brief glimpse of the deep truth that the immense universe is one gigantic enterprise of paternity. A passion to serve awakens within him. One day, in a fleeting instance of vision, his vocation appears clear to him. His whole life is suddenly orientated. He will be a father. He sets forth, heavy with his secret, strong and confident in his Lord. A woman's heart understands. She joins her gift to his. In a sacrament they consecrate their lives, which henceforward are but one life in one love. They are equal, they are equally loved by God. But man is the head. To him this great project has been confided. The child that will be born will be the fruit of their love, but it will bear the name of this man. It will be of his race. For this man is the father. To give life, to reflect God's fatherhood before his children, and to lead these to heaven, such is the vocation of a father. The gift of life. It is a solemn moment when man discovers within himself that creative instinct which, at times, makes him dream of adventuring along life's highways in search of a new world and inspires him with an overwhelming desire to dedicate his life to some immense labor. In the sacred aura of love, he understands that this creative impatience is a preparation for fatherhood. In marriage he finds the great work of his life. The empire he must found is his home. The new world he must create and explore is his child. Nor is he a father only in that moment in which he calls forth a new life. Day after day he must continue to give life to his child. Education is a prolonged creation. After having engendered a body, the father must awaken and guide to maturity an intelligence, a heart and a conscience. It is a long and exacting labor. Daily he must ask himself, are my example, my speech, my warnings, my patience, my demands and my advice really creative? This amounts to asking himself if he is really alive, for only life is creative of life. One can give life only by giving his own life. Too many fathers seem to ignore this. They are content, in the manner of a sculptor with his chisel in hand, to fashion from the outside another being which they call their child. This is not education. It is not thus that life is given. The father is not alone in undertaking and guiding to completion this work of education. A mother stands at his side. To assure growth, to give life, it takes two people united in one love. This is the great secret of education. The intimate collaboration of mother and father is the key to success in education. Their mutual love is the daily bread of the child. If he is deprived of it, a cry of pain arises within him, the complaint of a heart that is dying of hunger. The father is also creative in conducting the affairs of his household. The framework within which the children live, the material order and still more the moral order that reigns in the home is of inestimable importance in the child's development and fulfillment. The role of the father in this matter is primordial. He can never forget that he is the head. Yet he must not abuse his authority. This, too, must be creative, a gift of life. Authority and love are one and the same thing. The father is author because he loves, authority is love in action. This may not always be visible elsewhere, but it is evident in the family. It is important to recall at this point, that, cut off from God, the father is cut off from the source of love, his authority, then no longer the sacrament of divine authority, degenerates into the mortal travesty of authoritarianism. It is not enough that a father exercise authority. It is equally important that the child be receptive to it. A child cannot refuse the call to life, which is the first gift of his father, but he can close himself to other manifestations of paternal love. A father must then impart to his child a sense of true submission. This is in no wise the resignation of a slave, but an attitude of love, an opening of the heart. Submission is a part of filial love, just as authority is a part of paternal love. This submission is indispensable if the creative impulse of God is to work through the father and influence the child in whom the adult is little by little emerging. Indeed, much more than a future adult, there is in the child a potential people. Consider this little calculation: a man who has 5 children, each of whom in turn has 5 children, how many descendants will he have in 10 generations? A man is not fully a father unless he wishes to be the head of a race, unless he consents to be the king of a people and refuses all respite, on earth where his mission begins, and in heaven where his mission shall continue, as long as he has not led each of his progeny to the Father, whose humble servant he is. His responsibility is great, he risks bequeathing the stain of original sin. But he can also transmit a blessing which, in his children, will be a title to divine graces. The Father as the image of God. To those who know how to listen, all of creation speaks of the Lord. The storm thundering over Sinai taught the Hebrews something of the power of God. The nights filled with sparkling stars have spoken to the shepherds of every century of the wisdom of the Creator. Like creation itself, the Father is charged with a divine message. But his is much more essential, much more intimate and far richer. For the fatherhood of man is the revelation of God's paternity. The Father is the image of the Father. To no other creature has God given so generously of his trust, his power and his likeness. That is why we use the same word Father both to address him from whom we have received human life and to invoke God. Christ always spoke of fathers with great reverence and love. If you, wicked servants that you are, know how to give good things to your children. And again, a father had 2 sons. This love is the echo of Christ's love for his father. In the men of Palestine he found a diminished but very real reflection of that same love. In spite of their human frailties, they remained fathers, and Christ could point to them to reveal something of the nature of his own father without any fear of leading us into error. What Christ demanded of fathers then, he demands of them now and will always demand, that the image of God in them never be obliterated. To fathers, primarily, he addresses these words: Be ye perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. It is not only in the interests of his children that a father endeavors each day to be a better father, it is also to become a more direct revelation of God and therefore manifest him the more to those about him. Happy indeed is the father who has initiated his children into the divine mysteries. It is by thus exercising his paternity that a father disposes his children little by little to an attitude of soul that is truly filial towards God, and prepares in them a climate that is favorable to the development of the 3 theological virtues of faith, hope and charity. If a father can banish from his words all trace of deception and from his actions all trace of pretension and artificiality, the limitless faith his children will place in him will become the image and the basis of the theological virtue of faith. If he always responds generously and with all the effectiveness he can command whenever he is asked for help or advice on a difficult and confusing problem, the supreme confidence his children will have in him will become the image and basis of hope. And if he loves his children with the very heart of God, there will be in his love the something indeed far greater than an image and basis for the theological virtue of charity. Noblesse oblige. Can there be any stronger stimulus for a father than to know that he is invested with such a mission? When a father fails in this responsibility, he is guilty of a grievous crime. His indifference, his severity or his lack of consideration can have profoundly disturbing effects upon the child. A boy or a girl will know many bitter deceptions in life, but, if we accept that of a mother, none wounds more deeply than a father's failure. None runs a greater risk of destroying in them the very foundations of faith and of preparing in them an open revolt against God. By his desertion, a father not only betrays himself, he betrays God in the souls of his children. The seriousness of a father's failure only serves to evoke the grandeur of his vocation.